Yeah, you did.
Not so bad, fair enough. Time of year.
Reality creeps round and bites us.
Okay, let's start. So, if you remember the last lecture in computational logic, I was talking to you about truth tables. And so what I hope what you've done between then and now is spend a little bit of time just looking at the structure of propositional formulae. So the things that have particular atomic propositions connected with ands, ors, implications, nots, that sort of thing. A little bit of practice just in describing those sorts of things. You get some practice in your tutorials, so that will help as well. But do a little bit just in the quiet time that you've got. So you've got a little bit of a feel for that. And what I want to do now is to move on a little bit to something that's slightly different. Some of you may even find it a little bit more natural, I don't know. It's certainly more sophisticated style of proof. And I want to give you a couple of examples that link into that. One of them is talking about database manipulation, and the other one is talking about English grammar. I've deliberately chosen them to be very different kinds of examples to give you an idea of the breadth of things that you'll be dealing with. And I want to talk a little bit along the way about completeness of proof. Okay, so here's usual drill. I give you the problems first. So here's a problem. It's a thing called database join, joining two databases. So you have to imagine that you're managing a database and you have two different databases. One is talking about employees, and the database has two fields. One is a name, so every employee has a name, and they have an identifier. So there's Dave and some identifier. This is true in the university. I have a particular identifier for the university, my staff number. You will have a student identifier. And there might be another database somewhere that's been built maybe by somebody else at some point in time that's talking about lecturers. Maybe that's a database that the school has about lecturers. And that they'll have names as well, but also maybe their sex and their age. So Dave is male, age 42. And what you like to be able to do is to be able to take that sort of information and join it to get a new database where the lecturer name here is the same as the employee name here. So the name is the same in lecturer and employee, and the age is less than 50. In other words, give me from those two databases those entries that have the same name, but the age is less than 50, the youngish ones. I'm still there. I'm still amongst them. Newton. Pretty soon, this example's not going to work for me. So then, just to make sure you know what that is, you know, here's how it works. Imagine going through this methodically. We're going to describe it in logic at the end, but imagine going through it methodically. There's one where the employee name and the lecturer name are the same. Dave matches to Dave and lecturer. And the age is 42, so that goes across Dave with the appropriate entries. You take the union of these databases. Dave is male, 42. Actually, I'm duplicating the name from both. I could have taken out the duplicate entries, but I kept them in this example. So there's the name from here. The name from here, male, 42, and the name and the ID here. You're combining the two databases for the appropriate entries, right? Ken doesn't appear here, so it doesn't work. Mary does coincide, age 21, so that's less than 50, so does appear here. Phil, 64, doesn't satisfy this constraint, so doesn't appear, right? Okay, that's a very common operation to want to do on databases. So this is a new database built up from these old ones, given the constraints that you gave in the join specification. And I'll show you at the end how to do that sort of join specification in logic. Here's another completely different problem. Hard to see the connection. English grammar. This isn't a perfect English grammar, of course. This is a very, very simplified grammar. But what there's a large community of people inside computer science and outside computer science and linguistics that study grammars for natural languages, for human languages. Of course, you also study grammars for computer languages, completely formal ones. But for informal ones, to help you understand how the language is structured, you need grammar. When you're at school, you get taught different elements of grammar. Here's a grammar. It says a sentence consists of a noun phrase followed by a verb phrase. A noun phrase is either a noun or, so this symbol in this particular graphic notation means choice, or a determiner followed by a noun. A verb phrase consists of a verb or just a simple verb, or a verb followed by a noun phrase. Okay. And nouns can be things like Dave. A determiner is something like the, would be an example of a determiner. Verb bites would be a verb. Dust would be a noun. Okay, so a sentence like this, Dave bites the dust, you can show as a well-formed sentence according to this grammar by the following style of argument. You can say, okay, here's the sequence. Dave is a noun. Bytes is a verb, that is a determiner, dust is a noun. So sentence consists of a noun phrase followed by a verb phrase, right? A noun phrase can either be a noun or a determiner followed by a noun. Well, here's a noun, Dave. So that satisfies the noun phrase bit. For a verb phrase, it's either a verb or a verb followed by a noun phrase. So let's choose this one. A verb phrase is a verb, bytes, followed by a noun phrase. Okay. So a noun phrase is noun or a determiner followed by a noun. So let's choose determiner followed by a noun. Determiner, the, noun, dust. Now we've satisfied all the elements of our what would be called a parse tree. It looks like this looks like a tree growing upside down, because I like to draw my trees upside down. And that gives you your parse according to the grammar. And I can now say that sentence is well formed according to this grammar. It satisfies the rules of the grammar. Okay, and that's the sort of thing that people like to do in whenever they're analyzing natural language and trying to understand what the grammars are. So completely different domains, and we'll come back to that one on logic at the end as well. Okay, but before we do that, I have to give you a little bit more notation. Sorry about that. I never like giving people too much notation because it just feels like you're talking about syntax, but without syntax, you can't do much. Without knowing what you're going to write down in some precise way, you can't do anything much precisely with logics. So here's a little bit more notation. The thing in green here, this turnstile here, how many of you have seen that turnstile before in logic? Well, one, actually, very very small. That's quite interesting, because a lot of you were saying you'd heard about logic before. You haven't seen the return style operator. You see it quite a lot in what's often known as natural deduction. So what it means is simply that the expression here, A, can be proved from some set of expressions F, where F is just some sequence of expressions, expression one, expression two. Just think of that as being, for now, just think of that as being a bag of expressions expressed in your logic. Could be in the propositional logic you've seen. Might be something that contains variables, which remember you're not going to be examined on, but I'm going to talk about it a little bit because it's useful for some of the examples I use. Okay. Okay. This guy, the bar here, adds the thing A to F to make it a larger sequence. So you've got a bag of expressions, and that makes it a bigger bag. Actually, let me just write, just to be completely clear about what that is, let me write it down for you. So if I write A, and I don't know, A implies B, that would be an example of something, that guy there would be an example of something that would be like the F there. It could be an instance of F, a particular set of expressions. And that these expressions are axioms in your logic. A is true, A implies B is true. Okay, assumed for the purposes of proof. If I wrote C bar A implies B. What that means with this bar operator, the one that I'm using there, what that simply means is that. That's all. I'm just joining it on the end. So that's all you need to know about that. Nothing terribly fancy. Okay. And then this is set membership. This means that A is a member of the set F. So, for example, C is a member of that particular sequence. A implies B is a member of that sequence. Right. Okay, so as far as you're concerned for this, don't read anything fancy into what it means for A implies B to be a member. It's just an element. It's just a thing I can stick in a set. Okay. Whenever I'm talking about these kinds of logical things, do avoid trying to read too much into what the symbols are meant to be saying. It's very mechanical and clunky, and it's supposed to be that way so that you can understand it unambiguously. Okay, so now I'm going to give you something more to chew over. It's a set of proof rules. Now, I will never, in an exam, ask you to remember a set of proof rules like this one, because it's quite a lot to remember, and actually you get different sets of proof rules. This is not the unique set of proof rules for some very commonly used calculus of some kind. Actually, it's a subset of the ones that you might actually want to use. But it's a nice working subset for the lectures, and it gets used a lot in the notes. So what I do want to do is to go through each one and explain to you what each one means. And there's two purposes for me doing that. One is so that you know what they mean. That's a good reason. Second one is just to get you a little bit more practice on the hoof in thinking about these proof rules. Okay. So what we're going to use this table for is, imagine that you're trying to perform a proof from some particular F here, some particular set of things, and you're wanting to conclude some particular A here. Okay, that's the job. That's what we're going to do with this system. We're going to start with some proof. I want to, given the set of things I believe, this set of axioms, I want to be able to prove this thing. Okay? So that's the set of axioms. That's the thing we want to prove. And this tells you what's sufficient for proving it. What I need to be able to prove as a subproof in order to prove that thing. And typically these will be simpler things. So now if we keep moving, doing more and more of the simpler things and discharging the obligations to do these subproofs, we'll prove the thing we want it to prove in the first place. So it's like decomposing a problem into smaller components that we can handle. It's a bit of structure on the way that we're going to prove the thing we want to prove. And the idea is that each one of these makes sense by itself, but leaves us with some obligations if we want to do the actual proof. So, simplest one is this one. If I want to prove this from the set of axioms, if it's just a member of the axioms, like C or A implies B, then it must be true, because I said it was in the set of axioms, right? You have no problem with that, I hope. It's there, I can prove it. Right. If what I'm wanting to prove is a conjunction of things, A and B, so the and here means just the same as it meant in the last lecture, and I'm proving that from some set of axioms, I can prove it if I can prove A from the set of axioms, and separately, I can prove B. These little lines here are showing separate subproofs. They're done independently. So I can prove A from the set of axioms, I can prove B from the set of axioms, then surely A and B are both true. Question? No. So the subproof implies the main proof. Okay. In fact, that gives you a false. Anyway, we'll come on to this one in a moment. Okay. So if we have a disjunction, A or B, we want to prove that A or B, or possibly both, would be true, then it's sufficient to show that A is true. A or B, we only need to show A. Or alternatively, we have a choice here for this one, so the same expression, we could choose to prove B. Either one would be enough evidence to prove A or B. Okay, happy so far? If you're not happy, you have to somehow give me a sign. Hard to do, but you'll find a way. Okay, so next one is starting to look a little bit more complicated. So here we want to prove something C from this set of axioms F. And we can show that A or B is inside F. So that's sitting there. That's an assertion. A or B we know is true because it's inside F. And then what we do is we add A to F and we show C. And we add B to F and we show the same C. So really what we're doing here, this looks a little more complicated, but really all that's happening is we're spotting that there's an OR. So at least one of these is true. That's an assertion because it's inside F. So that's known. And since at least one of them is true, if we can prove the same thing independently with each one being true, then we conclude the thing that we want to conclude. Because regardless of which one is true, the thing that we want to conclude holds. Okay? So I say to you, something or something else is true, and independently you can show that regardless of which one of those two things you choose, the thing that you want to prove is true, and the thing that you want to prove is true, regardless of which, you know, regardless of the ambiguity over which one of these was actually was true. Happy with that one? A little bit harder, but I hope you got the intuition. Right? And you can go away and think about this, actually practice some proofs with this, and you'll convince yourself this is true. Okay. Next one, you want to be able to prove B from some set of axioms. And inside that set of axioms, you find that A implies B. And then to prove B, then you can try and prove A. In other words, so for example, here, A imply, if you wanted to prove B, and you know that A implies B appears inside here, then if you can, if that's true, then what you need to do is to try to prove A, which you actually would do. And the way you do it would be by this one. Okay. Happy so far? Last one is if you want to prove that A implies B, then the way to do that is to add A into F, let's assume A, and now show that B follows. Okay, so if I want to show that something implies something else, then let's assume the thing that is the precondition, put it into our set of axioms, it's an assumption, then having made that assumption, let's show that we can prove the thing we're looking for. Okay, I'm going to give you stuff. Some of these seemed a little bit, I'm not quite sure how they work. We're going to go through some examples. But first, you might be thinking, why on earth is he telling me this when he already showed me how I could prove propositionally all of these things? Truth tables do all of this. Why is he giving me yet another notation? Is this just rearranging the furniture? No, it's not just rearranging the furniture, because there are things that you can prove this way that you're not going to be able to prove, at least not in any generic sense, using truth tables. Here's an example of something that you're going to have difficulty with a truth table. Okay, and I have to introduce variables for some of these things, right? Because we're pushing a little bit beyond the kind of propositional area. So what this is saying, here we have something where I want to prove, and I've kept it very abstract. So I want to prove f of f of a, so this is some nested expression. Okay. So actually, if you're thinking about this, you're doing functional programming, you could think of this as being a bit like a kind of data structure. So I want to prove f of a from these two axioms. First axiom is that p of a is true, and I also know that if p of x is true, then p of f of x is true. And actually, I haven't put in the quantifier here, but this would be for all x. Okay, I'm not bothering with quantifiers for this. Just assume that that's a universal one. Okay, so that's not really easy to write down using a truth table, because what are all your propositions here for the x's? It's just describing a universal thing for any x. How big is your truth table going to be? There's all sorts of tricks. You could bound the domain that you're talking about, and then everything eventually you can collapse down into being propositional, because then you can make instances of all the expressions. But if you want to, but this is a universal. You're talking about things in general. Okay, so it's going to be hard for you to do this one with a proof table. But here's the proof in the sequent calculus I just gave you. So this is your first step in applying the sequent calculus. Here we go. Here's the thing we want to prove, right? This is just this. So this is your top level thing that you want to prove. First step. Okay. So what we're doing here is we're using, I've written up the rules that were on the last slide on the board, so I can point to them here. That's why I was doing that before you came in. So let me just move that one up a little bit. You see it better. May not be too easy. I hope you can see this well enough. If not, you can just try to remember the rules from the previous slide. So we're using this rule here. So F is that bit. B is that bit. And then we're saying the implication bit, that A implies B and F, is this bit. So P of F of A is P of F of F of A. Notice something happened here that we haven't talked about much before. That X got instantiated to F of A, right? Because we're matching P of F of A, P of F of X, right? So if that makes you go, don't worry too much about it, because remember, in the exam, it'll be all propositional. But I need it for this example, right? So All you need to know is that we're matching this to the x here, and then what we get is this guy. And since that's the same x as in here, this is f of a, right? What we've really got here, actually, this is something that you'll, this is a good thing to pay attention to, actually. Not for this course, but for the functional programming course, because you're going to see this in functional programming. What's going on here is recursion. This is where you have P defined in terms of itself, but on something that's going to be smaller. Okay, I don't want to actually, in this lecture, I don't want to give you a lecture on recursion. That you will get that in functional programming or things that approximate to that. But that's what's going on. It's one of the world's most powerful programming constructs. Okay. So meanwhile, back to the example. So now we've got this guy that's in this set, modulo the instantiation of the x. And now we need to do the other bit. Da da da. Proof of the A that's here. And the A is, right? P of f of a. There it is. So now we have to prove P of f of a from our original set. This is just the same as we had here. This just carries through. Right? So notice this is a smaller problem in some sense. The good news is this is a smaller data smaller structure than this was. So you can see where this is all going to end, maybe. Next step, so this trivially is true, right? This guy we have is a subproof. We have to be able to prove this. Because that's our obligation here. We have to do this bit. Same way. So again, we're using this rule. But the instantiation of the x here is different because now we're matching. We want to show P of f of a. And x now is going to be a because f of x matches the f of a with the x being a. And this is P of a. So there we go. P of a implies P of f of a is an axiom matching on the variables. In this set. And now we want to be able to prove this bit, because that's what this says. So now we want to be able to show P of A follows from this set of axioms. And that's real easy, because all we need to show is that using that rule up there is that P of A is in that set, which it is. And we're done. Now we have a proof. There's nothing more for me to do. No more subproofs that I have to do, so I've proved this expression. Okay, and in general, this is the way that things are going to go with these proofs. We're going to be picking rules from here. In the end, we're always going to end up on this one. All of the leaves of this downwards growing tree, all of the leaves of this tree, you'll notice, are memberships. Some axiom appears in the set of axioms. It's trivially true because you said it. Everything else is heading towards those leaves. So the name of the game when you're doing these proofs is to be very good at choosing which ones of these to go such that you're always heading towards an axiom that appears in that set. And that's, in some ways, that's all there is to it. But it's often quite difficult to make the choices of those axioms. We'll talk about that in a moment. Oh, it's choices of the proof rules. Okay. Okay, so the question is that better than truth tables? So I showed you something that I can do with the logic that I'm giving you just now that would be quite hard to do in the general sense with truth tables, but is it better? Well, not. And for that particular set of proof rules, that's not necessarily the case because, sure, there are some things that I can do. I just showed you one that truth tables aren't going to be able to handle. But also, with the proof rules that I gave you, which is not... That's not necessarily the full set of proof rules that you might use. There are some things that you can't prove. You won't be able to prove something like this. It's not true that P and not P is true. You won't be able to prove that A and B implies A or B. Okay. And the reason why is because I haven't given you a complete set of proof rules for the propositional logic. I could deal with those by adding in more proof rules. You might want, if you're that way inclined, you might want to give a little bit of thought to which rules you might want to add in or adapt in order to be able to cover examples like this. So if you're looking at, let's take, this one is kind of trivially. You can see why that one wouldn't be true. That one's not going to be true because I have no negation in here at all. I don't talk about negation in the proof rules. There is no proof rule that allows me to deal with a negation operator. Right? I'd have to add some in that talked about negation. Actually, in a lecture that later, I will be doing that. So that's something yet to come. For this one, it's a little bit more subtle because, sure, I've got proof rules that will... So I have a proof rule that will help me deal with the implication here. This guy here. I have proof rules that allow me to deal with A or B, but I don't have proof rules that is going to, that are going to unpack that AND for me. I have one that unpacks an OR in here, but I don't have one that unpacks the AND in the way that, that this is going to have to do it. So that's going to be more difficult. Okay, so in general, there are different questions you can ask about systems of logic. Oh, ask it.
Yeah, for the last example, can we use the second line for A and B can be driven by the...
Sorry?
Just use the second rule.
Wait, is this one?
Yeah.
But we have to be able to somehow, what we want, have a go and see, actually. But what you'll find is that these proof rules will introduce A and B as a structure inside your proof. But you won't have A separately and B separately. So what you'll have to do in here is to add A and B as a structure and as an assumption, right? Because we're going to use, the only way we're going to do this is to take this rule, which will put this thing, which will be A and B, the structure in here. So you have A and B, the structure in your set of axioms, but you don't. But that's a structure, A and B. It isn't A, comma B. This sounds trivial, right? But it means you won't be able to do this proof. Right, so you need another rule that would separate those out. Okay. Right. So you can there. In general, there are three typical things that people ask about these kinds of systems. And all you don't have to get very deeply into understanding how you would ask these questions or how you would answer them. I just want to make you aware that the questions exist for any system of proof. So one question is it sound? So sound means that it wouldn't give you the wrong answer. So if you have given whatever it is that you're using to judge what the right answer is, so if it was A and B, it means that it should only answer yes, that's true when both A and B is true, right? That would be what you would mean by the right answer for things that we're talking about A and B. So it shouldn't give you that answer in when it doesn't apply, when it is not true. So that would be what soundness is. System is always telling you the truth. By however you're measuring that formally. Complete means it gives you all the correct answers. Doesn't mean it wouldn't not give you a correct answer if a correct answer existed. Okay. And the third one, which is a little bit more subtle, is that it would actually be able to decide whether the answer was correct or whether the answer was correct or incorrect. Okay, which is a little bit more subtle because you can imagine something which in principle could be sound and complete, but there was no mechanism that would be able to decide that. Okay, there's the abstract property of being sound and complete versus the property of being able to have an algorithm that would be able to decide whether that was true in finite time. Okay, and so typically what you find with logics is that as you make them more and more sophisticated, you may keep soundness, you may sometimes keep completeness. You typically aim to keep soundness and completeness, but you may end up sacrificing decidability. So in some cases, you may not be able to guarantee that your proof system would terminate and give you an answer, even though in theory, given the set of proof rules you had, the answer would be derivable. Okay, so now I just wanted to give you one more example of a larger proof tree. And actually, I think you may find this one easier than the example I gave you before, because the example I gave you before had variables in it, and this one won't. So here's a larger proof tree. These are more like the examples you'll get in the tutorials and the sort of thing you get asked in exams and so on. No variables, just looking at propositions. So, oh, actually, it's a little bit, sorry, this may be a little bit confusing because I'm giving you these uppercase letters, which I usually reserve for variables. Sorry about that. These are meant to be constants. So I want to show that A or B implies A or C, given that B implies C. I want to be able to prove that. I'll just step you through this. Okay. So the first thing I do is I use this rule here. So what that does is say, okay, I want to prove this implication. So then what I do is let's assume that A or B is true, and now let's see if I can derive A or C from my new set of axioms here. So I've put in that assumption, and now I want to see whether the conclusion holds. And then the next thing I do, I want to show, I've got an OR in here. So I'll choose this rule here. So A or B is in here. And then I want to show separately that A gives me the proof I want to find, and B gives me the proof I want to find. So the proof I want to find is of A or C. So A or B is in my set of axioms. So given just A, can I prove A or C? And independently, given just B, can I prove A or C? Because if I can do that, doesn't matter which one of A or B is true. Okay, so now this has given me, this is trivially true, but now I have to prove this and I have to prove this. More work to do. So we take the first of those. I want to show that A or C is true given A. Okay, so then I choose this rule, so I can show A or B if I can choose the left-hand side, A. There it is. And A appears in here. So that's trivially true. So that's me sorted this bit. Now I'll move on to this bit. I want to show that this implies A or C, and now I'm going to choose the right-hand side, the C, so I'm using this one. Okay, so I can show A or B if I can do the right-hand side. There it is. And to do that, I use that rule. So I can show that this proves C if B implies C is in here, which it is, right? And then the precondition here, I want to be able to show that it holds. Because if it holds, by implication, C must. So then now I have work to do here. But you can see I'm nearly there because B appears in my set of axioms, so it's trivially true, so I'm done. Now, if you look at this tree, you can see I'm done because all the leaves of the tree are something appearing in the set of axioms. And everything else is the application of one of these proof rules, which I have argued that independently are sound. And so then you have to believe me that I have proof. Okay? Happy about that. If you're not, go and practice it. You get practice in the tutorials later on. A little bit about proof strategies. This is a table you've seen before. People who like to automate proofs and do automated theorem proving, and by the way, in informatics you have one of the longest lasting, wouldn't say the longest lasting, but because I'm not absolutely sure, but certainly one of the longest lasting research groups in automated theorem proving in the world in informatics. We've been doing this for a very long time. What people like that worry about is strategies. How do you, given, this is very nice. These things are lovely because they sort of, they appeal to your natural notion of what it is to do proof, at least for most people they do, in a way that truth tables often don't. But you pay a price. The price you pay is you have to exercise choice. And so then people worry, how can you make the choice easier? Later on I'll be talking a little bit more about yet another way of making that choice easier. But one way is by talking about strategy. Here's a strategy that you might want to use if you're trying to do these. Try that guy first, because if that guy first, you've got no work to do. So you should always try that first. Then if it's an and that you're dealing with, this, that's the obvious one to use because that's for an AND. For an OR, it's one of these guys. So you've got a choice which one, you have a choice. Then if it's an implication, you use that. So if it's an AND, choose that one. Implication, choose that one. Or it's going to be one of these two. Otherwise, and this is where it starts to get a bit hairy, it's one of these. So this strategy doesn't give you a perfect way of choosing. Unfortunately, there isn't really a perfect way of choosing. But it's, you know, it's a way of narrowing down your choice a little bit. Okay. Most of the difficulty comes in choosing exactly how to apply. Well, this one can sometimes be difficult. Often the subtlety is in these ones. Okay. So now on to the last bit where we do the problems. Okay, so here's database join. Remember that one? So we want to be able to join these two guys. First, something that we did before in the very first lecture. We'll actually formalize this problem in logic. And we want to bring it into the logical world, so we have to formalize it. So I'm going to use employee. First argument is that first name is the first field. Second argument is the second field. So employee Dave 2345 is, oh actually let me go back. So that's employee Dave 2345, right? Just translating the tables into something that actually looks remarkably table-like, but now it's in the syntax of my logic. Okay. Happy with that bit? If you like that, you'll also like that. Right, so it's just the same game. Lecturer Dave, male, 42. So these are the three fields for that one. So now I have represented in my logic, I have two different predicates in the jargon of predicate logic. I have employee, takes two arguments for the field of employee, lecturer, three arguments there. And then the tricky bit is to express, actually before I do the tricky bit, there are other things that you can do here if you want to be a little bit more precise about this. Remember I was talking about the boundary problem, how much of the problem you model. There is some more things that I could say in logic here. So one is to do with the types of things here. So this says if I've got an employee, it doesn't matter for any N and any I, then N must be a name and I must be an ID. Often people describe those sorts of things as integrity constraints on the database. So this is going a little bit beyond what just solving the problem, but quite often for databases you want to be sure when people are entering information into those fields in the database, you want to protect against it being the wrong kind of information, so they'll place types and integrity constraints on the fields. And that's what that's expressing. Okay. And that's the same for this one. Okay. Now, let me show you how to do the join. Okay. So here's how the join is specified. So remember, I want to construct this new table. If you cast your mind back to the beginning, I want to be able to specify how that's done in logic. So this says I have a new table. So this is the same predicate. These are the predicates in my original databases, and I have a predicate in my new database called new, and it takes n1, which is a name. The sex, the age, name two, and the identifier. That's true if I've got a lecturer with N1, see same N1, S, and A, and an employee, N2, and I. So really what this is doing is just moving identifying fields from here to here, right? All these map across. And N1 equals M2, N2. Remember I said in our original specification, we said the names had to be the same. And here's the second constraint, the age had to be less than 50. Okay. And then if we take this, imagine that was some big set of information for your theorem prover, the big set of axioms. And then we exhaustively try to derive these, find out all of these that we can get from this using this axiom. Then what we get is this. And you can go through and work it out. I'm not going to work this out in the lecture because it'll take me a little time to go in detail and show you all the ways in which this, a lecturer matches. So lecturer could be lecturer Dave male, 42, an employee, Dave, 2345, and Dave equals Dave, and this was 42, right? 42 is less than 50, therefore I get new Dave, male, 42, Dave, 2345, right? And you do that exhaustively, and this is what comes out. And then that's your new database. So that solves your problem for you. All you need is a bit of machinery that does this deduction using, say, a proof system like this one, and you will get the new database out automatically. Okay, so that's one solution. Here's the English grammar one, which is a little bit more complicated to think about. Okay, so this stretches you a little bit. That's what it's supposed to do. So remember, here are my grammar rules. So it's not database join now. I'm in the world of talking about human language and grammar. And what I'd like to be able to do is to be able to describe, first I need to be able to describe these grammar rules in my logic, and then I need to be able to use them to test whether a given sentence conforms to the grammar or not. So we're going to take this one step at a time. So first, let's think about this as functions. You're doing almost all of you, I think, are doing functional programming. Possibly absolutely all of you are doing functional programming, right? So let's convert this. Let's think about this as functions. Every one of these guys is just a function. It's telling you for a sentence, for example. For a sentence is the concatenation of a noun phrase with a verb phrase. This says sentence is you take whatever is the output of sentence is the output of noun phrase concatenated onto the output of verb phrase. Okay? Similarly, for a noun phrase, it's actually you have a choice. It's either whatever is the output of noun, or it's the output of determiner concatenated with the output of from noun. And so on you go. Okay. For the words in your grammar, then that's just telling you the individual element in the sequence. Every word is going to be, it's like a function that returns you a singleton sequence with just one element in it. Okay, so a noun can be either the sequence Dave or the sequence Dust. Verb is the sequence Bytes. These are the words that I'm recognizing. Okay? Now, that's what I just said. And here it is in predicate logic. So this looks a little complicated, but in fact, there's only really one trick going on, which I'm going to explain to you right now. So since this is predicate logic, it's Boolean, it's either true or false, it's not a functional language, then I have to have something that allows me to express the output of the function. And I'm going to use an argument to my predicate for that. So that S there is, think of it, if you think functionally, which I imagine all of you hopefully are starting to do on the other course, if you're thinking functionally, you wouldn't see that argument, because it would be assumed, it's the output. But this is a relational thing. It's talking about things that are true or false. So here we have an extra argument. Sentence S, and that's true if this is the output for noun phrase, this is the output for verb phrase, and C is the concatenation operator. And all concatenation does is wait till I get this right. I'll give you an example. Is join two sequences together, right? That's all that does. Right. So happy with that, reasonably? You're not going to get asked this in an exam. I'm doing this just to get you into the feel of all the very many different sorts of things that you can do with logics. Okay. Same for these. Same deal with all of these. For these ones, the output is just the sequence. So for these terminal symbols in your grammar, all you're getting is just a sequence with one element. Okay? So let's do it. Here's your set of grammar rules expressed in the logic. So the same as the grammar rules we saw before, but now I've pulled them into logic. So let's take, I'm going to build this tree from the leaves because it's easier for me to explain it that way. So I'm building it the opposite way around from when I was doing the proofs before. So now I've got a determiner. This is a determiner. Dust is a noun. And I can concatenate, I'm not sure I can say that too many times, the to dust and get the dust. That's what the concatenation thing does. And that gives me a noun phrase, right? So noun phrase, if I can get a noun, if I can get a noun or, it's the or bit I'm using, this bit, if I can get a determinator, determiner, the, and a noun, dust, and I can concatenate, blah, 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 that gives me that S. Have I got a verb and a noun phrase?